it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
What is up, everybody, and welcome to the All-NBA Show, part of the All-City Podcast Network. I'm your host, Adam Mattes, and I'm joined by my esteemed colleague, Tim Legler. Legs, jam-packed weekend of hoops, big-time Sunday with lots to talk about. How are you doing today?
I'm great, man. That's what you get on that second weekend of the NBA playoffs. You get a lot of moving parts. You get a lot of things that start to be coming to clearer focus, man. It was a great day of hoops, and I think for the Phoenix Suns, they might disagree. It wasn't necessarily a great day for them, but Minnesota was impressive, man. I think that's where we're going to start, correct?
Correct. We're going to start with the Timberwolves. We're also going to talk about the Suns. We're going to move on to the Mavs and the Clippers. That series is maybe the best one going right now, at least most competitive. And then we're going to talk about all the 3-1 series and who has the best chance. So that's obviously Nuggets-Lakers. We're going to talk Bucks-Pacers and Knicks-Sixers. Lots of notes there. We might even touch on Celtics-Heat a little bit towards the end. But first, All-NBA is sponsored by DraftKings. Stay tuned because you'll hear more about DraftKings and all it has to offer throughout the show. DraftKings, the crown is yours. Game 4 between the Timberwolves and Suns was a fantastic game. It was competitive. It was well played. But the story to me was the story of a young team. Well, I shouldn't even say young because they're not that young. But a team getting over the hump, an organization, a franchise getting over the hump, and a player in Anthony Edwards making a leap before our very eyes. He goes for 40 points, 9 rebounds, 6 assists, many of those in the fourth quarter. And at least one of those, a 100 out of 100 in terms of style points, an exclamation, tomahawk jam that basically ended the game. Legs, that was my big takeaway. Was that your big takeaway, was Ant and the performance he had in that fourth?
Yeah, definitely. And that dunk you're talking about, yeah, it was spectacular. We've seen him do that before. Incredible to believe. It might not even be the best dunk he's had in the last like couple of weeks, but it was more than 2 points. That was a lot wrapped up in that play and in that moment. First of all, just how great he is as an athlete and how far he's come as a ball handler, because I saw a lot of that in this game and his ability now to have a counter to what you're doing defensively, a counter off that first move. That is what takes you to another level as a player, particularly when you combine it with his level of competitiveness and just raw athletic ability. When you start to add the polish to your game, the mid-range, the deep shot, and then that handle to set that play up. So that's one part of it. And then the fact that, you know, he takes off from outside the paint and who's under the rim. I mean, you tell me that's not like some sort of just sort of a definitive summation of the series. It's Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant comes over, man. And Beal, first of all, is who he crosses up. And then Kevin Durant gets there late. He realizes his elevator is not going to go to the same floor that Anthony Edwards' elevator goes to. And he sort of just aborts his jump and gets out of the way. And Anthony Edwards flushes it to go up 4, 2 minutes to go. Like the emphatic exclamation point on his game, where he's come as a player, and certainly an end to the series. That's how it felt.
It was definitely an end. And it came off of, we just looked it up. Beal had 6 turnovers this game, none more egregious than the one that preceded that play. And it was so definitive. Beal had a disaster game. I mean, we'll talk about that here in a second when we talk about the Suns and where they go from here. But Beal, 31 minutes, just 9 points, 6 turnovers, and his final one was on the play before, where Minnesota, I actually thought Phoenix had good ball movement on that play, worked it all the way around the court, gets Beal cutting to the basket. Cat rotates over, And I think Beal should have challenged him on that play, got a little bit scared, throws it to the corner, another A-plus rotation in the corner to get the steal, and to go the other way and to finish with that dunk. It was such an impressive sequence. And they in a series full of impressive sequences for the Minnesota Timberwolves. But to me, I'm buying the Timberwolves. And I'm buying them in large part because defensively, they all seem to have buy-in. And they have elite players that anchor it. And Rudy Gobert, Jaden McDaniels, Nikhil Alexander-Walker. They have great players, but all of the team buys in and rotates. And you have a player who, half court or transition, Anthony Edwards, is just always up for the challenge and is able to put an emphasis, you know, like he did on that one. So that's why I'm buying him. That sequence, if you just chopped that 30-second sequence out and sent it out, you'd say, that's a championship team, because that's a championship sequence.
I feel you, man. I don't think you're overstating it. And I wrote down in my notes watching the game at the time, and I don't see every game obviously played all season long, and I certainly don't have a memory bank of every single possession in the NBA, but I'm just telling you, I watch a hell of a lot of NBA basketball, and I'm always looking for defensive sequences because they're great teaching points. And more so, and anything that's going to be run offensively, you can always teach more in what I do for a living by watching defensive possessions. And I wrote a note down that said, best defensive possession of the year. That was the best defensive possession I think I saw in the moment where I could actually track it with my eyes without having to see a replay. Like I saw it, and then I saw it five times after that because I kept rewinding it to watch it. I wanted to see it again and again and again. Yep. The number of defensive rotations made on that possession is just not normal. It's not something that you can expect teams to do. You're right, Adam. That's about as good as you can do if you're Phoenix. They didn't even, when they went around the horn with the basketball, nobody held it more than a half a count. It was immediately on to the next guy, like literally like you would draw it up in training camp in a shell defense drill where you're trying to work on both things at the same time, right? Ball moving around the perimeter, forcing your defense to close out and end up with a contested three usually. Like that's how you end up with possessions like that. But the last closeout was so good on Beal, they didn't even give up a contested three. They forced him to put it down one more time and he drives baseline and Towns comes over and you're thinking he's going to shoot a tough midi or something or challenge him at the rim. Instead, he makes a cross like along the baseline pass to the opposite corner. Now, if that offensive player had cut because of where Nikhil Alexander-Walker was, you might have gotten a connection for a layup on the opposite side behind Towns, but the guy stayed in the corner. So Beal tries to throw this really long pass along the baseline, and the last component of this possession, Nikhil Alexander-Walker sinks down 10 feet and intercepts the ball. And it was the most demoralizing thing that could happen to the Suns in that moment because they did what they had to do offensively and they could not find any daylight for a shot. And then you go to the other end of the floor and Anthony Edwards does that to you. It's the hammer. It's the pound the gavel. It's that moment. And look, you know, Suns kept playing. There was still a little, obviously 2 minutes to go, 4-point game. The game's not over, but it felt over to all of us. It felt over. Yeah. So I agree with you, man. It's not just that possession, but that kind of summed up what this team is defensively and how different they are than everybody else. And whenever Denver finishes off the Lakers, which they will, I'm expecting in game five, that's going to be an incredible series. And if you had told me 2 months ago, I wouldn't have thought that it was going to be an incredible series. At that time, Karl-Anthony Towns was out. I didn't have as much belief in Anthony Edwards as a superstar offensive player that there's no answer for. And it seems like he's kind of risen to that level now. He can get whatever he wants. And they got Towns back and that defense and Conley's grit and smarts is such a great addition for this team. So you add it all up and I think we are going to have a heavyweight brawl if assuming we get Denver and Minnesota in the next round.
I want to wait for that if it happens, when and if it happens, because we'll have time throughout the week to preview it. I agree with you. I think it might be the best series of the entire playoffs. That's how good I think that matchup would be. But let's just go back right now to what you were talking about with Anthony Edwards. Here's his fourth quarter legs. Tell me if this is good. 16 points on 6 of 7 shooting, 2 rebounds, 1 assist, 2 blocks, 0 turnovers. He was a plus 10. Those numbers are spectacular. They actually don't do it justice. He was better than that. The block he had on Devin Booker was just a pure, you know, heart and energy and seeing the court and everything else. And so many of his three-pointers, you know, all the stuff that he did in that quarter was just so clutch. And Kevin Durant, Devin Booker, Bradley Beal, Anthony Edwards, it was clear who the best player in the series was, and I did not expect that to be the case. And when you talk about that fourth quarter, hanging on for your lives if you're the Phoenix Suns, Anthony Edwards made it impossible for the Suns to win that game with how he closed out that tough shot-making, smart shot-making, and just this belief. After the game on Inside the NBA, Charles Barkley said, teams know when they have a dog as the leader and it's easy to follow a dog. I thought it was so simple yet succinct. Anthony Edwards is a dog, and the entire Minnesota Timberwolves team knows it and has his back and just like has such confidence because he's on their team. And that was the most confidence I've seen from them in the Anthony Edwards era of, we've got the guy. They don't. They just have Kevin Durant and Devin Booker, great players, but we have the guy in this series, and they closed it out.
And yeah, it was apparent for everyone to see, man. It was an eye-opening series, eye-opening moments that he's been giving us. And we'll even talk about the one game in the series when he didn't play well offensively. He never really got it going. Had one field goal through almost three quarters of the game and never let it affect his demeanor, his psyche, the way he was interacting with his teammates. He was all about continuing to compete defensively, didn't pout. And look, he's a young player. The reason I say, people might think you're unsurprised I'm saying that. I've seen that so many times, even in playoff games. Young players that are starting to kind of feel who they are in the league and getting a lot of attention. And then all of a sudden, you know, they know everybody's watching them and they have a night where for whatever reason, they don't get a lot of shots or they can't get one to go, whatever it may be. And they sort of just get wrapped up in their own game between their ears. And he never did it on that night. The other three games, he was spectacular. But that one night, he wasn't a big contributing factor offensively and he still was a leader. So that is just a massive leap forward in his maturity. And then the stuff he's added with his handle and his shooting off the dribble and getting to spots he wants where it doesn't have to be a finish over people or in spectacular fashion. Doesn't have to be that anymore. And he showed that in this one. And I'll just give you a couple of these plays you're talking about. So 6:23 to go. Durant hits a tough shot, cut it to one. Minnesota's up 102-101. Next trip, Anthony Edwards, 28-foot step back three. Boom, up four. Now here they come down the other end of the floor. Josh Okogie gets a dunk, so it's 105-103. Go down the other end of the floor. Anthony Edwards goes right up a ball screen, pull up mid-range, bangs a jumper, back up four. Royce O'Neal hits a three to tie the game with 4:32. Very next trip, Anthony Edwards, 24-foot step back three, puts him back up three. And then, of course, the dunk at the end of the turnover to put him up four. It's none of these were meaningless. That's the thing. Like this, yep. The game was hinging in the balance, and we all know what happens here. Look, Phoenix wasn't going to win this series. I doubt they were going to win game five if it got to that. But the fact that you didn't let this linger anymore, you didn't get it go on another couple of days where people are starting to build up hype as if the Suns are going to turn this, like all that stuff's a distraction to your goal. You have to show that you're able to put teams away when you needed to. And Anthony Edwards didn't do it by himself, but he hit these huge haymakers in this fourth quarter. Every time Phoenix looked like they were about to, you know, break that ice, Anthony Edwards was the main guy that had a response for that. And it was just incredibly impressive to watch, man. And it also magnified the issues with the Phoenix Suns on the other end of the floor and what is wrong with this mix and, you know, what that's going to look like going forward.
We'll get to them again here in just a second, but I want to ask we were talking before we went live about how, you know, you view the Timberwolves a little bit higher than you did say maybe a couple weeks ago. And look, the playoffs tell the truth. So the playoffs reveal what these teams really are and what they're capable of. So why, what parts of what the Timberwolves have shown you in here gives you the belief that they can be one of the teams? We talked about Boston. We've talked about Denver and a very small handful of other teams. Why would you put Timberwolves now in that top tier of, yes, these guys can win?
Well, the main reason that I now have elevated them to a team that, hey, you know, look, I'm not going to pick them if you get this matchup to beat Denver. But I'm telling you right now, they're going to throw a hell of a scare into them. And is it out of the question that they could win that series? No, it's not anymore in my mind. It's not. I think the main reason is Anthony Edwards. It's his removing the doubt that I have when I watch him play now offensively. That was the big thing. I always loved the way he competed. And you and I have talked about this. Like there's a look in his eye that's just different. It's been there and I appreciate it, respect it, admire it, all of those things. It was, is he going to be able to get into this category of player that there's not an answer for? You can't force him to something that's advantageous for the defense. Like those, that defines the great, great players in this league. There is no win for the defense. With Anthony Edwards, I thought there were things that you could force him to do that were not in his wheelhouse, and he was going to help you out if you could force him into certain areas of the floor, certain to take certain kinds of shots. I think that's out now, man. His confidence level on his contested jumper, on his mid-range jumper and his step back, his confidence level on that shot is so sky high. When you combine it with this outrageous first step to the rim and his explosive finishing ability and where he jumps from before your defense can rotate, when you add all that together, you now have a guy right now in front of our eyes. He's in that category. There's not a win. There's no longer an advantage of whatever you throw at him. Now, we'll see what kind of treatment he gets going forward. What we haven't seen is, hey, just a steady dose of blitzes. Yeah. Like, what's going to happen then? Is he going to make the right reads that lead to good offense? That doesn't mean directly sometimes. It means get it to the person that can get it to the person. And that's a read. And that's something right. You've got to interpret. We haven't seen Anthony Edwards get hit with a ton of that yet. Now, we'll see what happens going forward. Does it get to the point where you're going to dare Jaden McDaniels and dare Nikhil Alexander-Walker when he's on the floor to make Mike Conley not make a couple of important threes? How about make eight of them, Mike Conley, if you want to? Like, I don't know that we're going to get there. And if you have a really good defensive team like Denver or Boston, maybe they won't feel like they need to because they've got the personnel to live with it and deal with him taking tough shots where you force his efficiency down a little bit, and that's a win. We're going to find out. But right now, he's entered a different stratosphere of player that I watch, and I'm confident every trip he's got something good for you no matter what he's looking at. And that to me is the biggest reason why I view them differently, because nothing's really changed with their defensive personnel, intensity, game plan, none of that stuff. That's always been impressive. It was him. Was he going to be able to break through to this extent? And he's doing it right before our eyes.
Yeah, and they play connected too. And that's the thing about it, is this team seems to have a great culture. Somebody posted a video of Karl-Anthony Towns from 2021, and he was talking about how many different coaches they've had, how many different front offices they've had, how many different players have come through, and how hard it is when every year it feels like a completely different team. They get some stability in there. I know that it's funny to say that because the ownership is the least stable in all of NBA. But everything else, they get some stability in there. And it just feels like everybody understands the pecking order. Everybody understands their role and everybody executes it. And I am just such a big believer that is a foundational piece of winning a championship. You have to know who you are. You have to know what you're going for. And that team has shown that they know what they are and what they're supposed to do. And they're getting contributions from a lot of people. That being said, they beat up a pretty sad and pathetic team, in my opinion. We've been upset with this Phoenix Suns team all year. If you, as great as that rotation was on that play that we're talking about, the Phoenix Suns have not proven to be a team that can make the right passes. They made a lot of good passes there, but they're not a team that has proven to be a team that is going to really make a defense work over and over again. Should they advance and play the Denver Nuggets, the Denver Nuggets are a team that moves the ball extremely well, and plays like that, you can't have one of those in a game. You need to have a dozen, maybe two dozen of those in a game to stop Denver. So how much of this do you think is the Phoenix Suns? And as we move it to their side, is this an impressive win given all the talent there? Or was it more unimpressive that Phoenix just looked discombobulated for most of the series and then you get a stinker from Bradley Beal in a must-win game?
I'm gonna go in hard here on Phoenix a little bit, but I'm definitely gonna lean on this being something that's more of a statement in what it said about Minnesota going forward and what we just watched. Because look, the bottom line is this: yes, the Suns were disorganized. It's very difficult to run offense the way that they do without a point guard to help organize and set the table for anybody. The way that they play, and the fact that they really never had all three of their star players very rarely look comfortable at the same time. What's the point of having those guys if you can't figure out a way to run some offense that makes all three of those guys feel empowered at the same time? It was very rare when I saw that this year. That's an indictment on the team they put together and how they went about it. It's also an indictment on Frank Vogel, because that's his job. Okay, this is what I have. I don't have a point guard. I have three great individual scoring talents. How do we figure out a way, guys, to get this to look seamless and integrated and difficult to guard? How? And they weren't able to get there. And so, I'm not saying it's an easy thing. Some of these guys have egos too. I don't know how difficult it is to coach them or get them to play a certain way. They're used to playing a certain style. And if you're just going to live with that and hope that it's enough, got news for you. Not in the West, man. Not in this conference, not against this many teams that you'd have to get by. It's just not. So having said that, Minnesota still beat a team with a lot of playoff experience, guys that have been huge in big spots. Kevin Durant and Booker, you know, could go off at any time and get a win and start to get some confidence. And no, the fact that they went toe-to-toe in the fourth quarter when the Suns were desperately trying to survive, and they're the ones that made all the plays that mattered, the most important ones. No, right. I give the credit to Minnesota, man. And I think it's an indictment on the Suns' approach to how to put a team together. And you could tell by, you know, when it ended, and, you know, I'm sure there's going to be more fallout from this. There's going to be more comments coming our way, guarantee you, on the dissatisfaction of the way this all went from everybody involved. The one guy that will be super positive will be Frank Vogel. He's the guy that, because he wants to keep his job. So he's going to act like, hey, you know, tweak this, tweak that. We all know it's a little bit different than that. And I think the way that they just looked, the lack of cohesion that they had, that's an indictment on the whole thing, Adam, and the way they put it together and the way that those guys handled it.
So what do you do? You know, I mean, first of all, I got to give a shout out to Devin Booker, because in elimination games, it's kind of become a meme that he has had some of his worst games in an elimination game. 49 points on 13 of 21 shooting. He plays 45 minutes and is a plus one. Not on him that they lost this game, in my opinion. You know, he brought it in this one. Even Kevin Durant made some shots. But what do you do now if you're the Phoenix Suns? That roster is going to have no flexibility. I mean, unless you trade a major piece. But is there a way to talk yourself into, all right, things did not go well this year, but you still have three major pieces and we just built around them poorly. Maybe there's a better chance. Or do you feel like this is a story that once you cross a certain threshold, there's no recovering from it, and this a sweep in the first round might be that threshold? Which way do you kind of lean?
That way. I think that it's very difficult. You have a very hard time convincing me that this is going to be better next year. Oh, they just need more time together. Like that, I just don't buy it, man. It's not about that. It's not about that. By the way, Kevin Durant's just going to be 1 year older, and Kevin Durant still can light it up. He's still a great player. Nobody could sit here and make the argument that Kevin Durant is every bit what he was 4 or 5 years ago. He's not, and he's not going to be. Each year from here on is going to be less and less of that. That Kevin Durant's greatness can overcome a deck stacked against you on a given night. It can't. It can't. Not in this conference, man. It's too hard. And these younger teams that have been put together in a different way and also have young superstar offensive talent, good luck. You know, the Anthony Edwards of the world and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander's and the Lucas. I mean, these guys are that wave. It's here, right in front of you. It's going to be harder and harder going forward. So I think that they have to completely look at every bit of this and figure out a way to come up with something that more resembles the personnel that you are putting out there, that compares to Denver, that compares to Minnesota, that compares to Oklahoma City, where it's pieces that fit, guys that are in lanes that are really good at those roles, thrive it, embrace it, wrap their head around it, rather than let's just go out there with all this firepower, man, and let's just try to see if we can just, you know, outscore people and do it this way, particularly when you do not have a natural point guard on your entire roster.
Yeah, that's a big piece of this. Do you think that this loss with the Phoenix Suns, as well as some of the other losses, you know, the Lakers right now down 3-1, we'll talk about that in a second, but do you feel like this is a turning point in the super team era, that teams might look at this and say, you got three superstars but did not build a roster? That's an old way of doing it. Or do you feel like teams, there's going to be some team this summer that tries to reassemble some version of this team?
Yeah, there always is going to be, because, well, part of it's just your circumstances, where you have been as a franchise, you know, and the allure of that sometimes is hard to say no to if you have an opportunity to put it together. But I would issue this as a cautionary tale the other way. I completely disagree with the model. You do need two. You need two great offensive players. Yep. You can't do it with one. You need two great offensive players. Okay, and if you look around the league, that's what we're going to end up with. The teams that really go far in advance, you have to have two. Some teams have more than that, you know, but two is really the limit. And then I think that's the way you approach it. And then you plug in around that, man, defensive athleticism and length on the wings. Hopefully, if you're lucky, those guys can shoot the ball too, the way that Jaden McDaniels can and Nikhil Alexander-Walker. That'd be great, okay? Or Derek White or Drew Holiday, the way that they can shoot it around Tatum and Brown's offensive greatness. You need length, athleticism, defensive ability on the wings. You need some size in the middle, and you need depth at the size in the middle. Okay, you're going to have the ability to control the glass on defensively to finish off possessions. Really important. You need someone that's a role player, that's a ball handler, that wants to understand how to organize and coordinate and make the game easier for your scorers by facilitating some of the ball handling and taking some of the pressure off of those guys. Now, New York's a little bit of an anomaly in that, because Brunson, I feel like, got the ball the entire game for them, and it's amazing what he's still able to do. But I think that most teams, you need somebody that's filling that role that doesn't need a lot of shots, that's a wing player. Defense, length with your other wings, some size up front. Two elite offensive players can mesh easily. Three, it's a lot harder.
Last one for you. Do you – Chris Finch, crazy thing, at the very end of the game, the last minute and a half, he gets bumped into on kind of a crazy play and ends up tearing his patella tendon. You could tell he was in enormous pain. And just hearing from people who have suffered that injury before, he's going to be immobile probably for the rest of the playoffs. Like, he'll probably be a guy that has to be seated in some form or fashion. How does that, if at all, does it affect a team when your coach goes through an injury like that? Such a bizarre thing.
Yeah, very. And by the way, I was just traveling this morning. I didn't see the update. Did he rupture his patella tendon?
Man, to be honest with you, I don't know if it's a rupturing because, or a
I don't know. I just didn't get a word on the extent of it. But I mean, I heard ruptured a tendon was the last I heard before I went to bed. I flew this morning. I didn't get an update on it. If he ruptured his patella tendon or in some way damaged that, he's not standing up the rest of the playoffs, much less being on the bench. Right. And how do you even, you know, what they're going to have to go to the lengths to just have him be in the same position, like during timeouts, to be able to address his team. I really, this is uncharted territory here, man. I can't think of this ever happening. I don't know if there's been examples that listed, not in the NBA. I don't remember anything like this. This is going to be a very unique challenge for them. You still have his mind. You still have his grip on things, but being mobile is part of being a coach in the moment, right? In the moment, what it requires you to do in your communication ability, it's part of the deal. And some of the great ones, you know, like look at Eric Spoelstra, for instance. I mean, look at him in big moments in games. Like, is there anybody more active on the sideline, more actively engaging with the officials, out on the court calling timeouts, like whatever it takes? Is a much more difficult thing to pull off when you're just sitting there, which I'm expecting Chris Finch to be.
Yeah, that's just absolutely crazy, man. What an insane turn of events for him. And I mean, it might actually end up affecting things. Who knows? Such a weird variable that you could not possibly plan on, and we'll see what effect it has. All right, let's go to break. We got to get to the other game we want to talk about here, which in depth, which is, of course, the crazy win, the Clippers blowing a 30-point lead, but then somehow coming back in the final moments to beat the Dallas Mavericks in even that series. Who has the upper hand? We're going to talk about that on the other side. First, I want to tell you about AG1. AG1 is how you can get all of your probiotics, prebiotics, and a whole host of vitamins, minerals, and things you need to start your day to help you feel energized, adaptogens, and whole food source nutrients. You know, right now, a lot of people, their routine is just to drink coffee in the morning, try to give you a jolt, and then get you out the door. Is that good for you? Or you could try to get AG1, which gives you a mix of all of so many different things that you're going to need for a healthy lifestyle and create healthy habits. Right now, AG1 is a supplement I trust to provide the support my body needs daily, and that's why I'm excited to welcome them as our partner. And if you want to take ownership of your health, it starts with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free one-year supply of vitamin D3 K2. And 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase exclusively at drinkag1.com/allNBA. That's drinkag1.com/allNBA. Check it out. Also want to tell you about the presenting sponsor today, which is DraftKings Sportsbook. We're almost through the first round, and now you've gotten a look at all of these teams under pressure. So you can hop on the and play, get in on the NBA action at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. From the play-in, which is obviously over round one, all the way through to the finals, DraftKings Sportsbook has you covered with same-game parlays, live betting, odds boosts, and so much more. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code ALLNBA. New customers bet $5 and get $200 instantly in bonus bets. What a heck of a deal. Even if you're wrong, you get $200 in bonus bets. That's code ALLNBA only on DraftKings. The crown is yours.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Or in West Virginia, visit 1-800-GAMBLER.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas, 21 and over, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.co/bball for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources.
All right, back here, segment two of the All-NBA show. If you're watching live, do us a favor, throw us a like, hop in the chat and talk with people about what we're talking about. If you're late, leave us a comment down below. Let us know what your opinion is or any questions you have for the show. Let's move on now to the best series, or at least the most competitive series, the Clippers and the Mavs. First quarter legs, the game was over, 39-16. Absolute meltdown for Dallas, absolutely on fire for Paul George and the LA Clippers, including a Norman Powell three at the buzzer. This happens, man, when a team just has everything going and then they get sort of a prayer shot at the end and it goes in. It's like, of course that one went in. It just felt like a man, everything is going to go right for the Clippers. But the Mavs started chipping away after that little by little, led by Kyrie Irving, who I thought was spectacular for most of the comeback of this, and even gave them a go-ahead basket with about 2.5 minutes left that was a near impossible finish. Through three defenders, goes to his right hand, just unbelievable body control. You thought that there was no way a team could survive a 30-plus point collapse, but Paul George hit an impossible shot in the corner, and James Harden hit a series of floaters. He was spectacular in this one, 33 points, 12 of 17 shooting. What's your big takeaway from the Clippers surviving their own collapse? Man, what's your takeaway from this one? There's so many.
Well, my overall headline is this is a golden opportunity that Dallas did not capitalize on. I'm sorry. Yep. You find out Kawhi Leonard's not going to be there probably for the rest of the series, it doesn't sound like to me. And you have a chance to hold home court, go up 3-1, right? You feel like you're really absolutely in the driver's seat. And you have this opportunity to come out, and this is a team that was, by all accounts and every metric, was great defensively the last, 6 weeks of the season. And you have an opportunity to come out and really clamp down early in the game. Now, look, I'm going to say this, though. This wasn't like the Mavericks completely were just caught flat-footed. They didn't have energy. People are going to try to say, well, like the Kawhi thing, there was a letdown. I don't buy it. They still have Paul George, James Harden on that team. So I think you got to be up on your toes. I don't think it was that, man. The Clippers made a ridiculous number of tough shots in that quarter. Ridiculous. Now, what counters it? The number one thing is put the ball in the damn basket. And they could not. And I don't think, look, as great as Kyrie was the last three quarters, and make no mistake about it, I mean, he was absolutely incredible the last three quarters of the game. He didn't score in the first quarter. Luka was struggling. You want to slow a team down, make them take the ball out of the net. It stalls momentum. It was stop after stop after stop, miss shot after miss shot. Clippers come down, another tough shot, another tough three, another floater by James Harden. And so it was happening at the same time, and that was a 23-point lead. It's really everybody sitting there stunned at the end of that quarter. Everybody in the building, the Mavericks team, myself, maybe even the Mavericks, partly were stunned by what they were looking at. Now, here we go. Now the Mavs start playing, come all the way back, mainly through the greatness of Kyrie Irving. They take the lead with 2 minutes to go in one of the greatest finishes you're ever going to see a guard have. Over three guys, triple pump, gets the layup to go. They go up one, and you're thinking like, man, after all that, they're going to be able to hold on. And what happens? The very next trip, Paul George makes a step back three. Yeah. Very difficult shot in the corner. And it just felt like that was the one they absolutely – on that trip, that was the one they absolutely had to have. Or the Clippers are probably going to lose the game. But as a result, they hold on. They get the win. They get this thing to 2-2. I am not putting anything over the Mavericks and Luka Doncic and Kyrie in terms of, can they win another road game? Of course they can. They could even win a game seven. There's no question about it. They could do it. But man, oh man, the path would have been a lot easier if they won this game. And when you dig yourself out of a 23-point hole, Adam, most of the time, a lot of teams can erase that. A lot of times you end up coming up short because it's a matter of time before that team that got that lead starts making some plays again the way they did early in the game. And that's exactly what the Clippers did. So I just look at it as a blown opportunity or a lost opportunity. And some people might look at it, hey, no, it wasn't a lost opportunity. The Clippers took it from them. You can look at it both ways. Both can be true at the same time. If you're Dallas, you're at home, you don't have Kawhi Leonard to deal with, you've got to win this game to get it to 3-1. And they clearly never really had an opportunity. I mean, with the way that they started the game, were they going to be able to hold on there late? And the Clippers made enough plays once the comeback was erased.
And that possession you're talking about, Paul George made an impossible shot. It was all, it was probably more spectacular than Kyrie's, as spectacular as Kyrie's was, because I don't think it was a bad defensive possession. You forced Paul George into a sidestep almost over the backboard three. He put so much arc on it, the ball left the screen. You didn't even see it for a second, and it dropped in the hoop. It's just an amazing shot. And when you lend yourself to a close game, tough shot makers, you're vulnerable to tough shot making. This series, to me, Legs, feels like Denver versus Phoenix last year, where the Clippers have assembled a team that is capable of making spectacular plays. And when they make enough of them, even good teams are going to lose. The difference is last year, I thought Denver had a foundation and Jokic, who was playing unbelievably well. And you thought, okay, how many games can the Suns make that many shots? Probably not four. So you think Denver's going to win. And this one, Kyrie's been incredible. I don't want to take anything away from him because he's actually been that guy. But Luka, 29 points, 10 rebounds, 10 assists. The stat line's pretty good. I'm pretty underwhelmed. He's the guy to me that we expected to be the guy that you would say the Clippers are not going to make shots like they made in game four times. So the Mavs should have the upper hand. But I'm worried about Luka because he doesn't seem to have his shot down, and he just seems a little bit more clunky than what we saw at any point over the last 2 months.
Completely agree. And look, go to the source itself. Luka Doncic, after the game yesterday, said he's letting Kyrie Irving down. That's how he feels. He was honest about it. He was open about it. And he's 100% right. Luka Doncic has missed 62 shots in four games. He has missed 36 threes in four games. It's the difference, really, in the series. I mean, he is below, and I think significantly below, his peak level. And what we've come to know about Luka Doncic and the way he looked coming in, and everybody knows, you know, how I feel about Luka Doncic. I thought he had a great shot to win the MVP. I thought if the season lasted a couple more weeks, he might have won the MVP. That's how great he was playing. There's no denying he is not making shots at the level he needs to for the Mavericks to win this series. He's got to have one of those games. You think about it, he hasn't shot, Adam, over 42% in any game in this series.
That's crazy.
Okay. And you know, he's not going to have one game where he's over 50, where he has a 40-point game and it's efficient. Like, I feel like it's coming, but at the same time, four games starts to be like, this is a pattern here. Like, Terrence Mann is guarding him well. He's funneling him to the right spots. Now, I don't think there's any way to stop a guy as good as Luka Doncic because of that step-back three-point shooting and step-back mid-range ability. Like, you're not going to block it, deflect it. He's getting the shot off. But you absolutely can wear him down with the way you're guarding him and however you're being allowed to guard him, to where, you know, the legs just don't quite feel the same maybe on some of those shots. It's a little bit flatter than normal. The timing on the release is a little bit different when you're not in great rhythm. And that's what Luka's working through right now. And it's been four games of it. It's not one moment, one game. It's the whole series. So he's right. He has let Kyrie down because Kyrie's been great. Kyrie's shooting 51% in this series. Luka Doncic is the one that's right now killing them offensively because the number of shots he takes, the amount of time he has the ball, that ball has to go in at a higher rate. And if that doesn't change, they're going to lose this series.
Yeah. And I see somebody in the chat saying, you know, Luka's, you're holding him to such an insane standard because it's a 30-point triple-double average. You know what David Robinson averaged in the 95 series against Houston? Something like 28 points, 12 rebounds, 4.5 block shots a game. You know what they say of that series? he got dominated by Hakeem Olajuwon, because it's true. When you're a great player, you're going to put up great numbers. The question is, are you impacting the game? And Luka in the series so far has been, you know, putting up good stat lines, but not making the impact.
Let me address that comment, because that's just somebody that, are you watching the games? Like, whoever, are you really watching the games? Because you can't tell me you're watching the games and think that Luka Doncic is playing the same level he was coming into the playoffs. He's just not. He's missing shots he has to make because he's getting off looks. That ball's got to go in at a higher rate. I'm sorry. For a guy that dominates the ball to the extent that he does, and there's a lot of possessions when other people aren't touching the ball because Luka Doncic is hunting his own offense. That's the way he plays. And look, he's obviously more than capable of beating you with his passing. He's a guy that hunts, and he hunts immediately at the opening tip. And so I've said it about him this year. So I respect it because it never changes. Some guys come out and feel their way for the first 6 minutes. Luka doesn't do that, man. He's coming out. He's going to get himself going. That's the way Luka plays. When you dominate the ball to this extent, I'm sorry, man, you can't shoot that many times and shoot 42% for a series and have that add up to winning. It's not good enough. So if you're just going to look at his stats, if I were to tell you Luka Doncic averaged a 30-point triple-double, you know, in a 7-game loss to the LA Clippers at the end of the series, you'd say, wow, man, what a great series. But if you're watching the games, come on, man, you compare him to how he is at his best. That's all I'm saying. He's missing shots he normally makes. And if that doesn't turn around, they are in trouble. There's no other way to interpret it. Because especially since Adam, they're having a hell of a time guarding James Harden.
He's been unbelievable in this series.
And look, I'm going to give him his due because I beat him up when he deserves it. I'm going to give him all the damn credit when he deserves it. That dude is destroying them. They have no answer for James Harden, especially when he's hitting these floaters and getting into the paint as much as he is. It's one thing if he makes 6-7 step-back threes. You know, whatever. That'll happen on a night. You live with it. That's not what this is. This is a dude that is absolutely controlling every trip. When he's getting into this ball screen mode, you can't keep him in front. He's too strong for the guys in front of him, and he's making all of these tough little floaters and runners. Harden has been absolutely incredible in this series. So add the two things up. Luka, I think, significantly below his standard. Harden, above the way he has played this year for the Clippers. Add those two things up, and you got a problem if you're Dallas, if this does not change.
Who has the upper hand in this series? It's so tough. I mean, you have two games in Los Angeles, so it's natural to maybe just say them. But part of what I think happens here is you plan – if you're in Dallas, you plan for Kawhi Leonard, and it's a completely different team if he's not there. He's in, he's out a little bit. Now you kind of know he's probably out for the series. This is now Harden's team, so to speak. Who has the upper hand, in your opinion, based on what you've seen?
I think the Clippers do. I think the Clippers do now. That was a critical game yesterday, man. It was a critical game. And one of the reasons is because of what I just said. I don't think at any point in this series have I really watched the Mavericks at their best. And I don't know how much of it's them, how much of it is the Clippers defense, the different guys that are guarding, you know, their primary players. The first couple games, they completely shut off a big man effect, the Clippers did, of the Mavericks. Gafford and Lively, complete non-factors. Okay, so you got to do this like game by game. They did it early. Now, those guys have been more of a factor here, especially Lively yesterday. Okay, Luka has not had a game where he looks like the MVP of the league. He just hasn't had one of those games yet. They lose the first game, they scored 97 points. Second game, they win 96-93. Then they score 101. And then they get yesterday. I mean, they scored great last three quarters, but they still lose. I just feel like there's more, so much more the Mavericks have. But I'm starting to wonder, am I going to see it in this series? That's why I think the Clippers have played closer to what their personnel says is their best. And that, for me, is like I said, spells trouble for the Mavericks, man. Let's see what Luka comes up with in game five. Like I said, you can't rule out, Adam, them winning game five or game seven if they had to on the road with those two particular players, especially Luka. So I'm not writing that off. I'm just saying that yesterday, man, that felt important. That felt important to not get that win.
It, in a lot of ways, mirrors the Denver-Lakers series. Denver wins game two. You know, after playing poorly, they come back, but they close it out. And now we're talking about a 3-1 series instead of a 2-2. If it was 2-2, Denver Lakers right now and Murray's hobbled and he's questionable, you're looking at that going, I don't know. It's in the balance. But because you close out that game, the margin for error there is a lot wider. With Luka, it's two things. He's shooting 26.5% on 12.5 threes a game. He's got to either start making his threes or he's got to change his approach. And I'm curious to see which one it is. And legs, there's a lot of players that hunt fouls in the regular season and the fouls dry up. Teams focus a little bit more. Luka is a great player without foul baiting, and he's a great player without the three-point shot making. Yeah. Those things elevate him to MVP status. Yeah. If you're not getting those, in my opinion, he needs a mentality shift in game five because you don't want to count on the officiating, and you don't want to count on, is the ball bouncing my way from deep? He's got to get his head down. He's got to be more aggressive. He's got to get to the rim, and he's got to change his mentality. And if he does that, I still think if I still had to pick, I would pick the Mavericks because I think they have more to improve on. But as you said, it's a three-game series now, and anything is possible.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
We got to move legs, though, yep. So let's move on now to the series that are at 3-1. The Knicks and the 76ers, the Bucks and the Pacers, the Lakers and the Nuggets. We're going to talk about all three, but let's start with which team down 3-1, in your opinion, has the best chance of coming back?
Man, oh man. Here's my answer to that. If Giannis and Lillard make an appearance in this series, I would probably say them. But based on what I've seen and the limitations of those players and the way the Pacers played yesterday, I'm going to go with the Sixers only because these games are coming down to just a few possessions. And there's still a lot of fluctuation with, like, the Knicks offensively, other guys besides Jalen Brunson. I hated what Philadelphia did in the last 6 minutes of this game offensively. Absolutely hate it. I don't know what they're doing. I don't know if Embiid was like that limited in their mind that they couldn't run their normal stuff to get him the ball at the elbow or the top of the key. I don't know if it was Nick Nurse not demanding that they do that. I don't know what it was, but to watch what they did the last 6 minutes of that game is an abomination offensively, what they were trying to run and the areas of the floor that Joel Embiid was not touching the basketball. And look, give Brunson credit, man. He was spectacular. He was absolutely spectacular in the game. But Sixers have another guy that they don't have an answer for, right? Knicks don't have an answer for Joel Embiid. I know he's limited, but I don't want to use the limitation as an excuse only in the last 6 minutes of the game. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous because he's effective throughout the game. He just had a 50-point game. He was effective for the most part for the first three quarters of this game. So I think the Sixers, I have no idea what they're trying to do, what their identity is at the end of these games. And if they can somehow find that, Adam, they have a chance to go up and get a win in game five in a series where everything's been so close. Go up, get a win in game five, get home cooking. Maybe you force a 7-game series. I probably would say them because I don't know the status of Giannis and Lillard and what that's going to look like going forward in the series. And I don't think the Lakers have any shot.
So Joel Embiid in fourth quarters through four games is 3 of 18, 16.7% shooting in the fourth quarter. And half of those, or almost half, one of eight from the three-point line. So not only is he not taking a lot of shots, he's only made three shots in four games, three fourth-quarter shots, and half of those have been three-pointers. And to your point, like, who do you put this on that he was so passive in the clutch of that game and so just sort of out of it? Is it on him? Does he need to demand the ball be more aggressive? Is it on Nick Nurse? You know, is it on the Knicks? They're doing something. Who would you lay this blame on?
So I always look at it like this. If a guy, I look at where a guy's touching the ball and then what he does with it. This wasn't a situation where Joel Embiid was getting it in his wheelhouse and just wasn't attacking. I've seen players act that way, and it's 100% on them. They're clearly not confident in the moment. They don't feel it. They don't trust themselves. they're feeling the pressure of the moment. I've seen that happen a bunch of times to guys. But when I see a player not touching the ball in any area of the floor where he's really good and comfortable, that's on the coach. That's on Tyrese Maxey. That's on the other players on the court. Because he was going to the left corner repeatedly. And they were running action at the top. And it was like an afterthought of when he was going to get the basketball. Most mind-boggling thing in the world. I'm telling you right now, I guarantee you I could walk into practice today, and within 5 minutes, I would have something to get Joel Embiid the ball at the elbow at the top of the key. That's where he loves it. It's his favorite area of the floor to operate. If you don't want to throw it to him in the post, which he has been very limited in the post in this series, fine. He doesn't have the lift. Whatever you think, that's not an advantageous spot. He might turn it over against a double team. Whatever you want is fine. It's okay. The dude has shown you what he can do if you give him single coverage at the elbow to top of the key. He's going to murder you. In fact, he's going to single-handedly put Isaiah Hartenstein in foul trouble, which is what he did, running from that exact place on the floor over and over and over. And now, here we go, one possession game, 6 minutes to go. Oh, let's run you over to the corner and let's run some action with other guys at the top. Like, again, the one thing I don't know, Adam, is looking into a guy's eyes in a huddle. I don't know what Nick Nurse was looking at. I don't know what the tone of those huddles were, what was going on, and the discussions amongst his staff. Is something wrong with them? He didn't seem like he wanted the ball. I don't know that. I just know that what they were doing from an organizational standpoint offensively was really laughable. It was laughable what I was watching. And I kept waiting for him to get the ball in those areas, make something happen, force a reaction out of the Knicks, or draw a foul or hit a jump shot. And if you miss going down that way, Adam, you live with it. That's not what they did. They didn't get the ball to their best player in the best area of the floor. And so it's hard to live with that loss, in my opinion.
And Embiid's been very good. I mean, if you look at the series, just like, you know, what has he been throughout it? He's been dominant. He's been instrumental. They can't rest him, because every time they rest him, the 76ers, you know, blow whatever lead they've built up. So it's not like he's playing bad, but that, and even in the fourth quarters, honestly, we weren't talking about this after game two and game three. That last one was the one to me where it was like, you need it. It's a must-win game. And he just didn't seem very aggressive. And, you know, it's just such a strange one.
Can I real quick, right. I just got to say one real fast on this series. Another thing that's a big factor. Joel Embiid is a shell of what he was defensively prior to this injury, okay? And the reason that's so significant, Jalen Brunson should not be destroying them the way that he is by snake dribbling off these ball screens and getting to that 15 to 18 foot area. Embiid has a lot to do with that line of your defense because of his mobility and length. He is nowhere to be seen. So these guards who are not as strong as him, they're not as nearly as good as him. They're getting a ball screen, and it's pretty much on now the help defender to try to figure out how to contain Jalen Brunson, because you're not getting any sort of presence out of Embiid in the paint. I think it's a big factor in the series.
You said the Lakers have no chance of beating Denver. Jamal Murray right now is the worst volume shooter in the playoffs. He's shooting, I think, 37% from the field, and every game has kind of been the same. He obviously had that spectacular game two finish. But now news comes out that he's questionable. He's grabbing his calf during the game in game four when Denver lost. And look, Denver has won all of these games by the skin of their teeth. You know, they've had to come back. Murray has not looked himself. All four of his games so far in the playoffs, he has shot worse than 18 of the 20 games he played last year. So he's already had four games that are below the worst games that he played last season. So you say the Lakers have no chance, and I'm with you. Denver has three chances to close this out, including two at home. But I'm worried about Jamal Murray's health legs, because outside of one quarter, fourth quarter of game two, he has not looked like himself. And if he's not himself, Denver's going to have a hard time, if not now, certainly when they go to face Minnesota.
Well, that's what I was about to say. You can be worried about his health all you would like, Adam. That's fine. And I understand that coming from you. But you're going to be worried about that down the road. They are not – Lakers are not beating this team four straight times. So when you asked me who had the best chance and I said they don't have a chance, I don't necessarily mean they couldn't win game five potentially in Denver.
Okay.
Or maybe even somehow they win game six and it's 3-3. They're not winning game seven. So they're not beating a team this good four times. Jamal Murray, by the way, it's not like he's Now he's, you know, 4 for 18 every night. You know, he's like so close to breaking through and having an 11 for 18 game. It could come in the next game. And by the way, in the meantime, Jokic is doing whatever he wants, and they've gotten great play out of Michael Porter Jr., and they had one big game out of Aaron Gordon. That's the thing about this team. On a given night, other guys can supplement when one of the stars isn't necessarily putting the ball in a basket at a high rate. So I just think it's just too much, and I think it ends in game five. I don't think it even gets beyond that.
He's questionable for tonight, so I almost wonder, you know, sometimes with a game like this, you're right, I think Denver's the better team. I just think that's pretty definitive based on they've won 11 of the last 12 matchups. But it's almost better sometimes if he's just out and Denver could say, okay, we're without Murray, so we have to go to something else, as opposed to he plays and he just doesn't look like himself and he has an even worse night and you're trying to calibrate that all night. So tonight to me is a pivotal game in that series. I'm with you. I think Denver will find a way to close this out one way or another, but Jamal Murray is scary, and if he's struggling against Austin Reeves, Jaden McDaniels is going to have about 5 or 6 days off before he matches up with him in the next round, and that is going to be 100 times the challenge that this Lakers backcourt defense is.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
And then lastly, you know, you mentioned the Bucks and the Pacers. The Bucks were without Damian Lillard and Giannis. Then they're without Bobby Portis, who gets thrown out of this game wildly. Then they're without Chris Middleton. I don't even know what to make of this. The Pacers are winning by the skin of their teeth in this series, and they're going against, you know, Brooke Lopez had to go to the block. You've been calling for it all year. All it took was losing four of your key players, and now they're going down to Brooke Lopez in the block. Is there any note on the Pacers in this series? Because I just feel like the Bucks season is cursed.
Well, here's what I'll say about the Pacers that I think has impressed some people, and I've been watching this team a lot. I think I've always kind of been higher on them than other people a little bit, giving them a little bit, you know, more love and more credit, more shine whenever I could get a chance. I think what you're seeing in this series, I think you really saw it yesterday. They've got other guys that are pretty capable scorers. Like, this isn't all about Halliburton's show like it was during the, you know, the in-season tournament when that's all we talked. And then, you know, they added Siakam later, and like he's averaging 30 going into yesterday in the series. And then it was all about Siakam and waiting for Halliburton to have a breakout game. He finally did. No, man, look at some of these contributions of other guys. Nembhard's been great, and he's so good defensively. They get 24, of course, out of Halliburton. They get 13 out of Nesmith. They get 13 out of Obi Toppin, who has played really well. Then they get, like, TJ McConnell coming in, making plays as an energizer. I just think they've gotten more broader contributions up and down their roster than a lot of people thought they were capable of. So let's see what goes on with the Bucks and who the hell's even available to play for them, like, going forward. But the Pacers did what they had to do. You can't lose that game yesterday and want to be taken seriously with all the issues that they have and the guys out. You had to win that game. They did it. It was tight, but they did it. You're up 3-1. And no matter what happens in game five, you know you've got at least one game at home to close out this series against a limited team. So I've been impressed with them, man. And they're, you know, I don't know about beyond this. We'll see. But for now, let's just focus on them getting past the Bucks, winning one more game. And there's just too many X factors for the Bucks to really know what's about to happen.
Let's just quickly hit on this because we haven't given a lot of shine to it. But the Cleveland Cavaliers absolutely dominated the Orlando Magic in games 1 and 2 in Cleveland. You go to Orlando, the script completely flips. And all of a sudden, Franz Wagner, my guy, one of my guys, 34 points, 13 rebounds, 4 assists on 13 of 17 shooting. And my guy, he's hitting shots and turning to the crowd. I've never seen that from Franz Wagner hyping up the crowd. The Magic have 2 blowout wins now at home. So this is a series that is 2-2 with 4 blowouts. Is there an upper hand in this one? And what happens in game 5?
Well, I would say the upper hand, based on what we've seen to this point, has to be Cleveland. because they're going to end up with the last game at home. I mean, that's what it comes down to. Because the difference in these teams from home to road is incredible. I don't know if I've ever seen a series like this where you've had four games without one possession in a fourth quarter that had anxiety. That, I mean, that just doesn't happen in the playoffs, man. Unless it's a 4-0 sweep and it's four blowouts, not 2-2. So I'm as confused as you are of what we're about to see. At some point, doesn't it feel like we have to have a close game? And then maybe that'll give you a better indication of how this is going to go. But short of that, in games five or six, let's just go with the team that's got the most home games in the series, which is Cleveland.
Yeah, that's such an interesting one, man. And we might all be turning our attention towards it at the end of as some of these other series wrap up. We might be stuck, you know, down to just Dallas and the Clippers and then the Cavs and the Magic. So they might take center stage here after being the NBA TV game for most of the series so far. All right, let's close this out, Emma, with a couple super chats. What do we got? Let's see. Frank here, $10 super chat. Thank you, Frank. He says, do you believe Kidd is the long-term answer for the Mavs as head coach? I do not. He's made terrible, baffling decisions throughout the season that cost games. Lively should have played the fourth quarter. Legs, do you have a comment on this one?
I agree that he's not. I said, I don't know if you remember this, but I said at one point when they were really struggling before they started playing better at the end of the year that he was in trouble. If they lose in the first round, he's in trouble. No matter what the matchup is, he's in trouble because they've added the pieces. They had great acquisitions. Those are great acquisitions, Gafford and P.J. Washington. That's what front offices get paid to do, man, is make moves like that that are that impactful. Kyrie and Luka are gelling to this extent. You've got probably the most dominant offensive player in your conference on your team, and you lose in the first round. I don't care who you're playing. Short of the Nuggets, that would be the only team. Maybe you'd say, oh, it's bad luck. We ran into the Nuggets in the first round. That I think they're going to revisit that without question, because you know what's going to happen eventually is the star player starts to get dissatisfied when he's sitting home and other teams are still playing and he's watching them. That is usually the way these things go. So I agree. If they don't win this series, and in fact, if they win this series and then they play, let's say, Oklahoma City in the second round, they're expected to win that series too against a young team. No matter what, I don't care they were number one seed, they're going to be expected to win that series and end up in the conference finals. And look, if you play Denver in a tough series and you go home in six, seven games, maybe then not. Maybe you think, okay, we're close. Anything short of that, I think Jason Kidd could be in trouble.
And last one here comes from Cedric on the exact topic you kind of alluded to here. He says, do you guys think Luka would love to play in Denver? Here's all I'm going to say about this. Theoretical basketball in the middle of the playoffs when we have real basketball? Legs, what do you think about this theoretical basketball question?
Oh, man, I agree with you, first of all, man. We do enough theoretical stuff like leading up to the trading deadline and then free agency. You know, you know how much I hate the theoreticals. Give me something concrete to talk about. It would be an interesting pairing, to say the least, of Jokic and Luka on the same team.
Yeah, it'd be an interesting one. All right, that does it for today. Another great show in the books. What a great weekend. And then tonight, Lakers Nuggets. I'll tell you what, if the Lakers win this game, tomorrow's show, very interesting. We also have Celtics Heat. If the Heat win tonight, very
interesting. Remember what I said? Boston, you want to quiet all the noise? Go down there and win game three decisively. It's exactly what they did.
If you lost game two but you win in five, nobody remembers or cares about that. But if you That's go 2-2, woo, everybody's eyes are going to be wide open. And then, of course, the Thunder, who have been magnificent over the last two games, have a chance to get their own sweep and join the Minnesota Timberwolves as they are up 3-0 on the Pelicans. Do the Pelicans have anything to fight back? We'll be talking about those games and more on tomorrow's show. Thanks, everybody, for hanging out with us. Throw us that like button. Don't forget, subscribe wherever you get your podcast. So if you ever miss the show live on YouTube, you can just play it wherever you get your podcast. We appreciate it. We'll see you tomorrow. We all silly like the mayor.